Well, I'd like to turn now. I know that there's been a lot written about the political aspects and Moses and other people. Mm-hmm. William Willoughby, I believe, back yes. in 61, is other studies. But you chose to yeah. take a very different focus in this mm-hmm. book. You didn't want mm-hmm. to talk about those aspects of the project. You're really mainly focused on the workers and the work itself, mm-hmm. and using oral history and oral interviews to get into the workers, and you selected 53 workers, or you ended up with 53
yes,
workers.
I did. Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about how you chose those workers, or something about them as the general pool?
Yeah. Yes.
And then we'll get into individuals and individual stories.
This actually, the pool was sort of decided for me. I had many names of people, but it was very difficult to trace them. After 50 years, none of the contractors, if they were still in business, had any lists of their workers. And neither did, and even if the power authority had them, they didn't want to share. So it was very interesting to try to track them down. The pool I was very lucky with because I managed to get a lot of variety. Many of the laborers were local. And they stayed local. So that made it easy for me to find that. Also a company by the name of Ewell Hall and Rich was a created company for this project. And many of the workers stayed in contact with each other. So I was able to get engineers that way. And on the Canadian side, my biggest benefit was one of the workers is known sort of as the town gadfly. And if you're still in town, he knows you're there. And he provided me with the name of 15 workers who were still in town. And whether they wanted to talk to me or not was an issue. But he made sure that he gave me their phone numbers and addresses and said he would go knock on their doors if they didn't want to talk to me. So I had a lot of help in that aspect. But the variety was by sheer luck. And I was happy that I ended up with it that way because it could have been one-sided.
How many workers worked on this project?
22,000.
22,000.
Total. But that's, they did this sort of if somebody left and came back, you're not too sure. The most amount at any given time was there were 5,000 total on both sides at any given time. So people would go and come back, and
Were most of them local, or did they come from across the country?
They came from all over.
Yeah, all over.
I mean, the difference between the American side and the Canadian side was Ontario Hydro up to this point had their own workforce. They would bring them from one project to another, but here they decided to subcontract. So they still brought a lot of their engineers and their human resources people with them. On the American side, they came from everywhere because the Bureau of Reclamation was shutting down. Many projects of the TVA were obviously coming to an end. And people got jobs through answering newspaper ads. People knew the project was going on, so they would just travel hoping to get a job there. The locals didn't have the experience in a lot of aspects of it. So the majority of the time they had jobs as laborers or what they called seaway carpenters.
Seaway carpenters. your group includes masons, electricians, mm-hmm. carpenters, engineers, engineer helpers, dredging workers and supervisors, and restaurant workers, and we'll get to them.
Yeah,
we'll
I like the
them.
Restaurant workers.
We'll get to them. Office managers and truck drivers. Mm-hmm. So it's quite a broad group of workers, and they do come. I remember you had a number of people from Montana that had worked on projects, on dam projects in western Montana, I believe. A Bureau of Reclamation. So these folks, basically, did they follow projects from one part of the country to the other? Were they
peripatetic? Yeah, they did. They were interlopers.
Interlopers.
They don't like that term, but that's what they were referred to as. One of the things was that one of the supervisors from the Bureau of Reclamation from the Hungry Horse project, I had to say the name because I love the name of that project, actually was hired to work in Messina and then obviously brought people with him. So this is
John Bryant?
It was another gentleman.
I missed him.
He's mentioned briefly. He's not actually interviewed. He was older at the time. But what they would do is they would work on a project and then possibly when that came to an end, if they liked the area, they might stay. But then once the call came, as they put it, they couldn't resist. They were just, these gentlemen just thrived and still do on anything difficult construction. You know, the crummier the area, the better. Their wives didn't like that, but that's really what they lived for. And
yeah, I'm glad you raised that up. I was going to talk about the machismo and the sense of danger, and talk about this. You've got this book. We should say now, and we'll get to them later. Is not just about the construction workers. It's also about their families and their wives.
Yes,
I mean
do
not neglect the women in this book.
No,
the core of the core. You called them.
Yes,
or someone else.
Yeah, actually, I call them that, and they used. They were quoted as being that in the newspaper.
But there was tension, and it's in here, between the love of danger, or the pride in doing dangerous work that the men have, and the attitude of the women in there. Could you go talk a little bit about that?
Sure. That's a very interesting thing. A lot of them, I think, were, when they were young, as they put it, thought that this was a cool thing to do. Saying that you worked on the seaway, you were, they could tell stories at bars, you know, standing up on a 100-foot concrete wall and all of the dangers with it. What I found when I interviewed them was, looking back at it, some of them sort of admitted that there was a little bit of fear there, and that if they had to do it now, they wouldn't, because obviously they saw the consequences. The women, I think, sort of accepted that this was the type of men their husbands were, that this is what made them happy. And even though they may not necessarily be happy where they were living, as they put it, they wouldn't be able to live with their husbands' frustration and lack of interest in their jobs. It really, and they're still like that. When I interviewed them, it definitely came across. And it's just a certain, as they put it, mentality and work ethic that they had. That I suppose it does still exist, but most of them who are in their 80s are still working. So that sort of gives you an idea about that.
In terms of the machismo of the men and their the pride at being able to do dangerous work. It was dangerous.
It was very dangerous,
And
yes.
I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about the danger of the work itself. You've got accounts here. It's probably easier for me rather than to find the spot in the book.
Yes.
Accounts of accidents in there. Could you talk about the nature of the accidents, how frequent they were, a little bit of how dangerous they were?
It was very dangerous. And the accidents, of course, that they remember are all of the very gruesome ones. I mean, I interviewed them, they always wanted to, I interviewed most of them by phone because of the distance. They would want to find a room in the house or a time when their wives or their, you know, anybody was, they didn't want anybody around. But there were many horrific accidents, anything from electrocutions to falling on rebar to some gentleman lost both of his feet. He broke both of his feet falling off. Some workers were never found, whether they were churned up by the water or they're in the concrete, no one knows. But the workers wanted to really tell me about the dangers, but they also wanted to tell me that this wasn't necessarily that unique back then. They wore fedoras to work. They didn't have masks when they painted. This was just the way that they worked. And they knew that the danger was there. And they had to, if someone was injured, they had to process it, and they had to go back to work the next day. And that's just the way that they had to function. The biggest horror for them was to not be, have something to do. If they showed up for work that day and they had to sit there and think about all of the things that had happened or could happen to them, that's when their minds started to I don't want to say play tricks on them, but they started to have their doubts about what they were doing. But none of them ever told me that they considered leaving because of the dangers. So that has to say something, I suppose, about it. The other thing that they liked to point out to me was, if you were injured on the job but you died 2 weeks later, it didn't count as a death on the project. So that's why the numbers are so low. Mm-hmm. If you died of pneumonia, you died of your injuries somewhere else, it didn't count. You had to physically die there. So that's...
The you said that they were afraid. The thing that they were most afraid of is not working.
Yes.
What we're talking about a place that's pretty far north, and the winter work must have been really tough, and there must have been many days where you just couldn't work. Could you talk about the restrictions on the type on labor itself, both from the environment as well as the human limitations? Yeah. That, for example, labor disputes that may have stopped work, things of that sort. So if you could talk about both of those.
The weather definitely was an issue more for the Americans than for the Canadians, because the Canadians knew how to work in the cold. They only stopped for 2 or 3 days every winter, and they poured concrete throughout the winter because they had developed a mixture and a process to heat it so that it would work. Obviously, dredging didn't.
Wait. Why didn't they share that process with the Americans? I mean, they're working on the same project, for God's sake.
We knew. Another aspect of machismo, do I want to say. They didn't share that. They had concrete pours that were 24 feet high. They'd pour 3-4 days. The Americans would do 5, 8, sometimes 10. But they didn't share that technology. The Americans put hay on theirs. The Canadians tarped theirs off and hired people just to heat the mixture. And that's why their side is in a lot better shape than ours. But they just didn't share anything about their design or their concrete. And nobody really can,
So the crews didn't mix?
No. They mixed in terms of where they stood. They had to have passes to go back and forth between the two projects. But I did not encounter, except for equipment operators, anybody who was able to go back and forth. If you were hired on the American side, you worked on the American side. The only gentleman I spoke with who went back and forth, actually two of them, it had to do with dredging. The equipment operators, one went to work on the Canadian side in the winter because there was an island they were working on. The other was loaned to the Americans because he had done a lot of dredging surveys on the Canadian side, and the Corps wanted his expertise. The labor part is an interesting thing. The Canadians had a deal going into the project with all of the labor unions about how much they would get paid, what the hours would be, and they had had the same agreement on the Niagara Falls project. So they didn't have to worry too much about it. The only time there was a possibility of a strike was they threatened a wildcat strike on the Canadian side, and one of the workers I interviewed said all he had to do was walk up with pink slips to the top of the dam and start asking people whether they wanted to be fired or not to deal with that issue. So that was interesting. On the American side, the operating engineers went on strike because of a renegotiating of contracts. There was an issue about the fact that they wanted to pay new workers more than existing workers, and there was a debate about that. There also was they walked off the job site when it was too cold one day and protested that. So they were not used to the weather. And they had the ability to shut it down, whereas the Canadian side didn't. So it was a different dynamic there, too.
In terms of the workers that you interviewed, how many of them were from the Canadian side?
About half. Okay. And they had a tendency to stay with that type of work longer because they could go on to another project with Ontario Hydro, or they could become an administrator with the Seaway. So they were easier somewhat to track down than the American workers were.
And these workers were mainly employed by the contractors themselves?
Yep.
You said U-Haul and Ridge on the American side, and then Iroquois contractors?
Yeah, what they did on the American side was they hired, on the American side, supervising contractors. U-Haul and Ridge was a civil engineering firm, and then they would sub out the contracts through a bidding process. Mm-hmm. So they, were dealing with contractors there. On the Canadian side, they created Iroquois constructors to sub out the work. But the gentlemen who ran Iroquois constructors all had construction companies themselves. So it definitely was a pool of the top contractors at the time, but they were all under the supervision of the Corps of Engineers or the power authority. They were the money the funding and the final decision were made.
Now, there were people employed to work out disputes among contractors, right? They were hired for that.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of disputes, what issues came up?
Well, one of the main issues, and it got resolved through many hearings after the Seaway was over with, was that if a contractor negotiated a contract, say, for example, for excavation, and they encountered something different than they had anticipated, they were basically told to foot the bill and that they would be paid later. They could file a change order. They could file for more money. But, of course, obviously they had won the bid because they were the lowest. So several contractors went bankrupt, especially with the excavation. Others, like the Perini Corporation, got $8 million after the project was over with in settlements. So it was a very interesting situation. And most of the time, the negotiations would take place, first of all, at the design level, at the local level, and then it would go up to the legal level and then to the power authority or the, you know, federal state entity. But they relied on local workers, the people on site, to tell them what they needed to do to solve the issue. They call them the claims denial department instead of the claims adjustment department. So
with all these contractors and with up to 22,000 workers coming and going, there must have been a severe impact on local communities, both on housing mm-hmm. and education. Could you talk a little bit about how the communities dealt with them and their response to the onslaught of all of these workers?
Well, initially, the workers were met with very negative newspaper articles. They thought that the workers coming in were going to ruin the community. There would be a lot of public drunkenness and other things. And they also, both Messina and Cornwall, were not given money to build housing. So that definitely was an issue. There wasn't a workers' village, except for the engineers. They did build some houses for you all and rich engineers. But other workers had to find, whether it be a trailer park or an apartment or travel from a nearby town. So there wasn't really much financial support for the local towns. The one thing that it did for both areas was that in terms of businesses, particularly bars and restaurants, it was a boon for them. It was people made so much money during that time period, and they never saw that much money again. But all in all, considering what could have happened, the crime rate did not increase. They found out that these people were there to work. They drank a little bit more than other people, and sure, they knew how to have a good time, but they wanted to keep their jobs. And if contractors found out or their supervisors found out they'd been in a bar fight the night before or they had done something inappropriate, then they could be fired. So there definitely was that type of control there on their behavior. And, you know, most of them were just happy to have that type of job and get paid that well and not have to move for several years. So I think the local population expected the worst and benefited financially from it, at least for a short time period.
We don't have a lot of time, so I want to turn give plenty of time for our discussion of the core of the core.
The women.
The women, the wives, and the single women, and issues of childcare and other things. Why did you include this in the book? Why did you obviously very consciously did this. Mm-hmm. Could you explain that and then go into some of what you learned from examining their lives?
Well, this was one chapter that my publisher didn't want to put in. They didn't see the necessity of it. This and the political chapter they did not want in there. But what I found about interviewing the women was that I got a completely different side of the story. They weren't working on the project. They were dealing with issues that many women in the 1950s were dealing with, and they were also dealing with it in a very isolated location. It also interested me because they were, when I started this, the same, you know, age I was. They had children. They were dealing with childcare issues. They were dealing with the sort of conflict between a work life and a home life. And they stood at that sort of time period where they were highly educated and they wanted to work. But society and in many cases their mother-in-laws, didn't think that that was what they should be doing. So I get a very interesting dynamic, not only about what it was like living there, but what it was like for them personally. And I think that was what was so intriguing to me. They were not only very willing to criticize living there, but to criticize each other. And considering the fact that they all still know each other and some of them live near each other, they didn't seem to have any qualms about that. So that was completely different than interviewing the workers, who were a little bit more guarded about it. But, you know, they had a lot of issues. They were isolated from their mothers, aunts, relatives. They had to craft a life. They had to craft relationships with other women for childcare or support. And they also had to struggle with the fact that probably, as they put it, if they had grown up 30 years later, life would have been a lot different. You know, they like to quote Dr. Spock a lot about childcare and daycare. And the other thing is they wanted to really hear about me. They wanted to know how, after I talked to them, how life had changed. They wanted to know if their struggles and their issues had been resolved in the present day. So it was a very interesting interview process.
Were there any women who actually worked on the project?
There was one reporter who went out and interviewed many of the workers, but supposedly she was bad luck. So they stopped working when she came by. A lot of secretaries, a lot of what happened, not on this project. There was one who was the secretary on this project, but when they moved on to other projects, like the one at Niagara Falls, one woman was a secretary and was privy to all of the issues within the office as well. So once their children got older, when they moved on to other projects, they did have jobs. But, you know, it was... I never found any evidence of any construction workers being female. I don't think they would have left them on the project. It's bad luck.
Right. But they did they did staff the lunch cart.
They did like the lunch cart. I love that.
Eunice Barkley
was
one?
Yeah. She was one of my favorite interviewees because there was something very interesting about her background that I didn't put in the book. Not that she hid it much. But her mother was never married. So she was a single mother. And most of the children did not have the same father necessarily. So she had – her mother had to make a living, first at a restaurant in Cortland, and then she went to the Seaway Project and had her lunch cart. So she had to deal with the stigma of people always asking who her husband was and where her husband was, and also having to work all day with all of these children. So – she definitely was an example of a woman who was unique during this time period. And the workers really respected her an awful lot and appreciated her a lot. So it was, and it's something that her children have not forgotten. Her daughter was actually the daughter is the one I interviewed. And she spoke so highly of her mother. And she's... in many respects, she's in her 80s now, is very much still like her mother. So it was very interesting.
Well, Claire, you know, I have probably another few hundred questions. Our time is coming to an end right now. But we've been talking to Claire Parham, the author of The St. Lawrence Seaway and Power Project, an oral history of the greatest construction show on earth, published by Syracuse University Press, just in time for the 50th anniversary of the formal opening of the St. Lawrence Seaway. And I understand you'll be speaking up there at their ceremonies.
Yes, I'll be speaking the evening of July 9th. It's a tribute to the workers that night. So many of the workers who are in the book will be there. Many of them have passed away, so their wives will be there. So it's going to be an interesting weekend. I'm speaking on Thursday night, and then there are many festivities at the
Visitor Center. And this will take place where?
In Messina, New York, from July 9th to the 11th.
Okay. And maybe some people, some of our listening audience will catch you there.
Yes,
thank
that would
you
be great. Thank
so
you
much.
Very much for having me.